Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 310 of the Roguecast, recorded October 21st, 2020. Spooky hello to Rogues Gallery.
It's time for another spooky podcast.
Have we been doing spooky podcasts?
No, but it's Halloween, isn't it?
That's another one in the of the many that we have done over, like, what, a decade of making this podcast?
Sure. Yeah.
Or however long it's been.
I actually don't know if anything particularly spooky is going to happen. It's October, and I feel like it should be spooky.
Oh, well, that ghost behind you is kind of spooky.
What? It's like Haunting Hill House. They're everywhere.
They are.
You know, what I will try and do is inject some spookiness into everything I do.
That's why when you come in, instead of saying hello, welcome to Rogues Gallery, Dave says, boo!
Actually, I say spooky hello to Rogues Gallery.
That's nonsensical. I like it.
Spooky hello to Rogues Gallery. So, yeah, there's not a ton of games news this week, but there are a couple notable things. One is the big new Curse of Strahd, speaking of spooky.
Right, yeah, Curse of Strahd, the famous gothic adventure, and it's also a setting, basically, for D&D. Mm-hmm. They're kind of Transylvania.
Walk out of the store with a tiny coffin.
Yes, and they have...
Not tiny. It's a big old coffin.
Compared to an actual coffin.
Okay, big by game standards, small by coffin standards.
More like cabbage... good for a Cabbage Patch Kid.
Yeah, yes. That's true.
Oh, God.
Look, I could have said a real kid.
Oh, that's true.
Not being that dark.
At least you did Cabbage Patch.
People out there will be like, what's a Cabbage Patch Kid?
Dead is what it is.
So they have had out a Curse of Strahd book for in hardcover for some years now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this has existed in various forms since like the 80s when the setting was created. But this is a big, fancy, lovely box set that is in fact packaged like a coffin, in a tin that is coffin shaped. It's got the book in it. It's got like the sort of
screen.
Tarot deck that is the that plays a role in a lot of these stories and has
screen. Invitations, custom invitations to invite people to your game.
Yeah, it is like an all-out thing. And honestly, although $100 is a lot, as a gift D&D type item and for a setting where I think, honestly, anybody who like runs it, you probably should kind of do the dim the lights, put on candles, do a little bit extra with the trappings to make it spooky.
Bite someone in the neck.
I think if anyone deserves a slightly some flourish to its production values, it's probably...
Nah.
Ravenloft, by the way, is the setting.
Yes.
And Count Strahd is their Dracula.
He's their Dracula.
He's a somewhat complex and conflicted villain and an interesting character in and of himself.
Now, I want them to make another one where it's like shaped like a cardboard beholder.
I like that.
Yeah.
Also, though, you know, they've been doing those figurines of adorable power, little puffy, cute versions. I want a little figurine of adorable power Strahd that's just like a little pudgy.
Okay, you're veering into like pop territory. Let's not go there.
That's what the figurines of adorable power are. And even though
they're better than pops, cooler looking.
I agree. They don't have those dead shark eyes. You know, when was it Robert Shaw in there?
Yeah.
He's like, that's the thing about a shark's eyes, Chief. Like a doll's eyes, dead eyes.
They're like pop figure
That's
eyes.
What pops are. Dead eyes, Chief.
Are you telling me that Robert Shaw was the creator of pop?
Yes.
I mean, sure, I'll go with it.
We also got the Kobold Press Tome of Beast 2, which has some cool monsters in it. I love those guys. They do awesome art.
Their answer to the Monster Manual is kind of unique in the sense that they do exclusively... non-traditional monsters.
Right.
It might be like a goblin, but it'd be some weird version of it. So that your players, when they go up against any of these creatures, they ain't going to know what they're going up against. Right.
There's otter folk in there.
There is otter
There's
folk.
Also an ogrepede, which is an ogre
centipede. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's disturbing.
It's weird. It looks like it's like some Frankenstein-y type creation.
Yep. But yeah, it's cool. And we also, we have, I think, one copy left of Layers, which actually gives you a number of possibilities to use these creatures in.
Oh, that's neat.
So yeah, it's...
And I think that, you can kind of drop them in any setting and all that stuff, And their production values are basically as high as any, standard D&D thing, or Pathfinder.
It's also a somewhat light Newsweek, although one of the bits of news is pretty big. First of all, a correction... Turns out Tatiana Maslany is not playing She-Hulk.
Yeah, it was sad.
That was one that seemed like it was kind of a lock, but
I
don't know.
Down.
I feel like it was reported somewhere like Hollywood Reporter or something like that.
But, yeah, it wasn't like a fly-by-night site.
But they had take-backs. There was a take-back.
I will say, it took a while to take it back, though, so it makes me think like something fell apart.
There's contract negotiations or something,
I saw some people hoping that it was like, you know, maybe still being negotiated and might still happen, but this was, it hasn't been lost.
The most likely explanation I've heard is from a friend of mine who works for TV, or writes about TV, and she was saying, you know, Alison Brie was in the running.
Yeah.
And with Glow being canceled, Alison Brie may have become free.
Yeah.
And I honestly would prefer Tatiana Maslany, but I can see where they're like, that's a bigger name. Alison Brie would be a person to get. They may have gone that way. We'll see. Michael B. Jordan is producing a live-action Static Shock TV show, which is pretty cool.
So it's a TV show?
Yes. I believe
for
that's
HBO Max, I would imagine?
Oh, no. It's a movie. No? It's a movie.
That's what I was thinking.
Dave's right. It's a movie. I was thinking it was a TV show.
Interesting.
I'd rather have it as a TV show.
Yeah. It would. I feel like it works.
I don't know.
Better.
I kind of like it as a movie because it is like, that is a place to really like get an audience's head wrapped around a movie like that. Or that character like that. Static Shock was born of the Milestone comics in the 90s.
Yep.
But I think probably most people who, if they know about him, probably know about him from the cartoon.
Yeah.
Emergency care. Come see us. There's an ad there. On that site.
We just decided to throw in an ad.
I was looking up the information about Static and I started playing an ad.
But I'm talking about Static.
I know.
I never saw the Static Shock cartoon, though. Did it interact with any of the other cartoons? Didn't he show up on Justice League Unlimited at some point?
He did.
But, like, the show, was it mostly its own thing?
Yeah, it was mostly its own thing.
Okay. I would love for another African-American hero to get a notable movie. He's also, like, a cool teen hero, and there actually have not been that many teen hero movies. There's like Spider-Man and
Static Shock very much was like the Spider-Man of the universe.
Yeah.
He was really likable. They did some good stuff. It's probably the best thing to do outside of Icon.
I would love it if it was just background, but like if it was set in Dakota, the fictional city that most of the Milestone stuff at least started in.
Well, Reginald Hudlin is developing it, and he was one of the guys, I believe, at Milestone.
Mm-hmm.
So. And he's definitely one of the guys working on Milestone now.
Right. Fingers crossed on that one. I think it could be pretty cool.
Final bit of news is the big one, and that is the DC is canceling all their comics. Sort of.
I mean.
So dramatic, Randy.
So what they're doing is they're suspending all their books, and in January and February they're gonna basically put out this thing called Future State, which is a series of one-shots, miniseries, and oversized anthology issues. Which basically shows a possible future of the DC Universe at the conclusion of Dark Knight's Death Metal.
I mean, is this just because they had this already in the can?
The 5G
and they're like,
stuff?
They're like, how can we use this since we've already paid for it?
It does feel a little bit like the 5G stuff that we saw like teased out.
Yeah.
So there's the Batman family is basically Gotham City controlled by the Magistrate, a villainous regime that is taking control of the city under constant surveillance. All mass vigilantes have been outlawed and Batman has been killed, but an all-new Batman and an assembly of Gotham's guardians have risen to give hope to all those who lost it. So there's a new person of color Batman, and looks like there's a Harley Quinn, a Nightwing, Batgirls.
So are all those individual titles going to have their future versions?
They're all like going to be miniseries or one-shots.
Okay.
The Superman family is kind of interesting. It features Shiloh Norman as Mr. Miracle. That's the other Mr. Miracle.
And, like, Clark has been, like, exiled, right?
Yeah. Yara Flor as a new Wonder Woman from the Amazon rainforest.
Oh, interesting.
Becky Cloonan is writing a Midnighter series.
Huh.
The deal is that Superman, due to his involvement in an international crisis happening in the near future, Clark Kent has been rejected by Earth, causing him to focus his life-saving efforts outside his adopted home. He travels to Warworld to rise to the ranks of gladiatorial combat in order to defeat Mongol with the help of some unlikely heroes. Back in Metropolis, Clark's son John is taking on the mantle of Superman. After seeing the horrors that befell Gotham, he bottles Metropolis in order to keep it safe, putting him at odds with Supergirl.
This all sounds actually really interesting.
It's weird.
You know what I was thinking? DC hasn't had, I think, a kind of definitive future since Kingdom Come in the 90s. And that was like early 90s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And sometimes it's fun to have one that you can play around with. Like Marvel will do their 2099 stuff with ties to the mega corporation of the future, Alchemax, and stuff like that. It's kind of fun to be able to play around with those, have some time travel stories and stuff. And I don't know if they're doing that, or if this is the last hurrah of DC before they go digital.
Yeah, we have no idea. I have to say, the stuff doesn't, like, super thrill me, but I always love a good alternate future, so yep. I'm definitely going to give it a look and see if it's good.
Yeah.
We shall see. But, yeah, it's going to be an interesting time in January, February with DC. Yeah. Having
People who are subscribed to those books, is going to auto-transfer over?
No, we are not transferring it over. We're going to have people...
So, in other words, they would have a break month for 2 months unless they tell us otherwise?
Correct.
All right. Well, they should tell us otherwise.
Yes. All right. That's all the news. We'll be back in just a second to talk about comics for the week. We're talking comics for the week of Wednesday, October 21st, and it's a lot of like number twos and threes and the regular suspects this week, but there are a few new things in the mix.
Yep.
I guess, first of all, the notably maybe, the new Dune book is out.
Yeah, this is the, I guess this must be a mini-series, ultimately, although I don't know how long it runs, but this is called Dune House Atreides, and I believe it adapts one of the books that came out. You know, there's been, what, 8, 10, 12 Dune books? I don't know how many there have been.
I don't know about sandworms.
Something like that. But it looks like it's, I'm going to guess, takes place 30, 40 years ago. Paul, the star of Dune, is not yet born. This is about his, among other things, his father as a young man sort of ascending to the throne. Or not to the throne, but to dukedom. This is a young Baron Harkonnen taking over the control of spice production on Arrakis, which is when Dune begins. If you haven't seen or read or seen, Randy, basically the Harkonnens are turning over control of spice production on Arrakis to the Duke, to Duke Leto, from the House Atreides family. But what he quickly figures out is that it's essentially a trap that's probably concocted by both the Harkonnens and the Emperor. To setting him up for failure. It's a sort of complex political trap. But this is all backstory on the characters. I'm trying to think who all else is in here. There's a few that I don't know, but a lot of characters who will become notable in Dune, this is sort of their younger days, and it's kind of what you expect in Dune, which is political machinations. There's the Paul's grandfather, who was notably got killed in a bullfight. There's like some
a space bullfight?
No, it's just a bullfight. There's some weird earthly traditions. It's almost like feudalism has essentially returned in Dune's time, so that you have all these like sort of you know, wealthy houses running things. But there's no robots that or AI, because those were like outlawed during like a big revolution like centuries ago. So they have Mentats, which are like human computers instead. But anyway, the net effect is, I think Frank Herbert wanted to make this world that was this weird, far-flung future, but yet feudal. And that's why you can see its influence on Warhammer 40K.
Okay.
Ground troops are still, like, what carries the day. There aren't big space battles, like, at all.
But they do have ornithopters.
They do have ornithopters, but they mostly just get them around here and there.
What is an ornithopter?
It's a helicopter.
That's what I thought.
It actually, I think, has a, like, it's from... ornithology is birds.
Birds.
Yeah, so it actually has wings on it, and I think
flies like a flappy bird.
I believe it is not chukunk 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 kind of flyer,
oh.
But more like imagine a buzz hum that's like,
yeah, it's like a kind of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool space hummingbirds.
Cool space hummingbirds. Yeah. There's a famous scene in Dune where they've just gotten to the planet, and these big spice crawlers that move along and process spice and occasionally get destroyed by sandworms if they're not careful, where the Duke sees, like, they know that he's flying around in an ornithopter touring one of them, and they see a worm approaching, and he's like, we got to get those guys out of there, and he, like, throws all, like, the seats and stuff out of his personal, like, royal ornithopter thing, and to get the spice workers on there, even though, like, their orders are to stay and work almost to the last minute, even, you know, if they get killed, basically. Yeah. And he saves a bunch of them, and it's supposed to show that this guy is, like, he believes in people over money.
All right, okay.
This scene begins with a young Baron Harkonnen in almost the exact same situation, where he's like, my money! is like, get me out of here! You know? Anyway, it's just kind of funny. It's pretty good. It's a little bit suffers from that same thing that Smallville type stuff did, which is like oh, all the characters you know seem to have notable roles, yeah, or and they all seem to know each other or have crossed paths in, you know, this universe of, you know, thousands of worlds and stuff under the Imperium. But it's drawn in a cool European style. It's got a it is a rich setting, and I'd say it is a solid kickoff to it. So anybody who's like anticipating the movie, which has been pushed back, or is just a sort of a fan of that sort of Dune brand of sci-fi in general, check it out.
Did anybody read The Werewolf by Night that came out this week? The new Werewolf by Night?
I did not.
So I gave it a look. It is a new Native American Werewolf by Night.
Yep. Did they say, is it like sort of something like a Skinwalker legend?
They don't really get too far into it. What's weird is it's actually, the story is like, they've got Red Wolf, the sort of Native American.
He is
a federal marshal now, and he winds up, he and his partner are like tracking down super criminals, and they wind up sort of running into this guy and his girlfriend, I think, who are basically using the wolf for vigilante justice on the reservation. There's a Pharmaco story going on. They don't get too into like the his full, like, they do talk about it, his origins, but it's like, I don't think there's like a laid out, here are his origins and he is a
Skinwalker. They're gonna get around to it.
Yeah. But yeah, if you like werewolf tales, and there aren't a lot of them, now this is an interesting new take.
Well, I'd also like to see a little bit more of maybe the Marvel Universe has lensed through Native American eyes.
Yeah, yeah. And then also there was, I know this has been anticipated by a few people, Scumbag number one.
Another an oily book from Rick Remender.
Yep.
Right, Rick Remender, who's best known for Deadly Class, which got turned into a show that got canceled, but people still liked it and liked the comic.
This is him, and artist is Louis LaRosa. The art's really nice.
It's this seamy painted look.
Yeah.
It's like, it's painted, but it looks like everything. It looks like a sleazy Times Square bathroom in the 70s.
So the premise of
my
this
kind
one
of place
is that this guy, the titular scumbag, is a... He's a scumbag.
Randy,
he's
you like, want to read the description? It's on the first page.
Oh, is it?
It's literally the first page. They use. There's some descriptor of him that I used in the sign.
Is there?
I'll quick.
Yeah, you find it because I don't know what you're talking
about. Yes, sir. Here we go. Ernie's a profane, illiterate, drug-addicted ne'er-do-well with a fifth-grade education, and the only thing standing between us and Total Armageddon.
Yeah, that's the pitch. Yeah, because basically this guy, and he is really terrible. Like, if he finds something, he shoots it up. I think he shoots up heroin in this one. He is, like, in debt. He's on the run. And he winds up running into this street brawl between a couple of, like, super spies. And one of them has this super serum thing, and this guy shoots it up.
Is this, like, a little bit like the sleazy version of Chuck?
Yes.
Where instead of an average man, like a kind of a nice guy kid getting these kind of spy
possible
powers,
yeah,
basically your skeevy drug dealer got him or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, exactly. this is going to have, whether or not you enjoy this, is going to have a lot to do with whether you like this particular brand of excess. I think fans like Garth Ennis.
Darkly comic, kind of in
yes,
that way.
Yes, very darkly comic. And like I said, the art's really nice. I know there's a few people who have been looking for it. It is definitely a very weird book.
It's kind of book where I think if you think you're going to like it, you're probably like it.
Yeah.
If you think it doesn't sound like your thing, it's probably not your thing.
the other sort of jumping on point that I saw this week was Amazing Spider-Man number 50.LR.
.LR? What does that even mean?
It means Marvel's screwing around with numbering again. They have this storyline called Last Remains, and it is so big that they had to expand out into a separate miniseries of like four issues. That is going to be like 50 through 54.LR. It's co-written by Matthew Rosenberg, but Nick Spencer, the Amazing Spider-Man writer, is writing it. This feels like Amazing Spider-Man. Like, it is directly picking up with Spidey, his allies all have been possessed by the
Sin Eater stuff?
No, not Sin Eater. Who's the other guy? Kindred.
Okay.
And so he's having to fight all his allies. Norman Osborn is going through some stuff. And it feels like of a piece with what's been going on with Last Sins, which I've actually been enjoying. And I think this is a good issue too. They're doing some fun stuff with it. So
I guess the only frustration would be that they chose to number it in that odd way instead of just saying, "Oh, Spider-Man's going to have double issues this month."
The issues
may have
biweekly
like
instead of like doing this little side thing. But if you're reading Spider-Man, I would definitely recommend picking this up.
Okay,
Nick, what's new in the world of X of Swords? Ten of Swords.
I was going to say the things I wanted to talk about deal with sex and mutants, and the sexy book is of course. Faithless, which remains one of my favorite books.
Brian Azzarello's naughty comic.
And this issue, things start coming into focus, which I was actually kind of surprised. Like, most of the time it's been kind of plodding along. It's always fun to read, but it's
like... You're not sure if it's going to congeal. Cohere?
This is where things start kind of... The shit hits the fan.
Okay.
And it's a really, really interesting swerve for the book. Then all the X-Books, X of Swords, is just great. There's so much fun to be had here as, like, all these mutants that I love find their different swords and deal with their, the problems that they're having to deal with. Like,
what did you tell me the Hellions try and do?
The Hellions
this was the book that sold out last week, I guess.
Yeah, they're essentially trying to thwart the entire game.
Like trying to cheat their way out of having sword fights.
Correct. And it's a team led by... Actually, Mr. Sinister is going out in the field. And it's written by Zeb Wells. And it is very akin to what he's been doing in, like, the D&D books. But yeah, then, you know, dealing with Cypher and whether or not he is actually a sword fighter, which he's not, but...
Yep.
Yeah, and then there's stuff this week with
Cypher
Excalibur.
Was never great with the physical combat.
No, but his mutant ability, you could kind of write it in such a way that he can...
Right, almost like Chuck or something like that. He could learn the language of combat.
But
have they done that at times? You're on Chuck kick this week.
Yeah, have they done that before where he's like learned...
No, but our friend Paul Benjamin had a pitch for it.
And it looks like I felt like
I had heard this idea before, and that's because of Paul Benjamin's pitch, which I'm blowing right now. Sorry, Paul.
It was awesome. It was going to be good. I don't think they'll ever do it at this point.
Marvel's a bunch of dum-dums.
Well, they're taking Paul's pitch and sort of utilizing it a little bit.
Monsters.
There also looks like an issue of X-Men that focuses on Apocalypse. I haven't read it just yet. I also see that Banshee makes an appearance, so that's awesome. And then the other book I think people... Actually, I don't think you mentioned was the Batman White Knight Presents Harley Quinn.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Which is a one-shot focusing on Harley Quinn and the White Knight universe.
Didn't we determine yesterday it was a six-parter, Randy?
It is.
Oh, is it a six-parter?
Yeah,
okay.
I know. I was flipping through it, Randy and Nick, and the ending, the last page feels like it could almost be an ending. But apparently it is the beginning.
Okay, cool. So this is co-written by Sean Murphy. The other writer is Katana Collins. And the art is by Matteo Scalera.
It's really nice.
And it's beautiful. But I stepped out of the White Knight stuff just because it kind of wasn't like pushing the buttons I wanted it to for me. But this stuff looks really interesting and sort of dealing with like... what Harley Quinn's home life is, and...
She's got, like, twins in this alternate
world.
She
does, but she also has Bud and Lou, the dog, the hyena, still. So...
Is she romantically linked to anyone, or is she a single mom?
Single mom.
Okay. Joker alive or dead?
At this point, it seems dead, and Bruce is in prison.
Okay.
So, it's some interesting developments. I don't know. I don't know where Ivy is.
Ivy, come help your girl. She got some kids. Give him some plant juice to drink.
Yeah, the tagline, which is actually pretty cool, on the back of it says, "The Joker is dead, Batman is behind bars. In a new age of villains, only Harley can save Gotham." Which I thought was kind of a fun idea.
Yeah,
I would have added on a line about how she's got the kids need some plant juice, but that's just me.
But that was sort of about everything I had. Dave, was there anything else you wanted to
throw in? Let's see. Fantastic Four hits an issue 25 sort of... anniversary issue, and like I think it's a new artist on this, and kind of a new, it's still Dan Slott writing, but I think just a new notable storyline. I don't know who is this artist. It's super good.
R.B. Silva, like the classic.
R.B. Silva, yeah.
Oh, he was doing some of the X-Books.
Yeah,
his artwork on this is super good, and but I haven't read it yet, so I don't know what's even afoot there.
There's a bunch of number twos this week. Juggernaut number two, Iron Man number two, which I actually thought Iron Man in particular really was better than the first issue.
Okay.
And Stillwater number two, which continues that great
Zdarsky
book.
That's Chip Zdarsky's new kind of horror-tinged thing about a town that where maybe people don't die. I really like that second issue. I think it was probably my favorite comic of the week.
It was really good.
Oh, and there is one other, I guess a slightly bigger issue is Nightwing 75, which is the return of Dick Grayson as Nightwing.
I was going to say, was he not... he wasn't calling himself Nightwing while he was
part of this weird group that all referred to themselves as Nightwing, and he didn't remember who he was. He was Rick Grayson. Now he has all of his memories back, and he's back in the costume.
It was Rick Grayson and the Nightwings.
But this is a big issue, sort of a beginning of a new story, him versus KG Beast, and it's written by Dan Jurgens. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to mention was a manga that came out this week. I always like kind of the Star Wars manga stuff, and I didn't get to read all of this, but what I read was interesting. It's called Star Wars Leia, Princess of Alderaan. And I guess this would like maybe fall into, what do they call it, shoujo manga? You know, the girls manga sort of style. Yep. There's actually a really beautiful color section that kind of recaps events from the various movies, including the prequels and, you know, the difficulties surrounding her birth and what sort of what things are like. And then it presents young Princess Leia growing up on Alderaan, sort of right on the cusp of kind of having to become the tough gal that we know her as.
I really like the art.
Yeah, the art's really nice. It's a fairly realistic style. I only read a little bit of it, but what I read I liked, so I'm going to read the rest. And
did it sort of feel akin to the other Star Wars manga?
Yeah, a little bit. That one I know was based on some like YA book.
I didn't know that.
I have no idea if this is. I didn't really read up on it. But
it's cool though.
But yeah, it's good.
All right, that's all the comics for week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about movies and TV and other stuff. One of the silver linings that people don't really talk about with COVID is how we're all stuck inside all the time, and so we can watch lots of TV and movies.
That's true.
That's true.
Yeah.
It almost makes it all worth it.
No. but even if we had not been stuck inside, we all would have jumped on Star Trek Discovery, which had its season 3 premiere.
Yep.
And we are somewhat split on in that two of us liked it but have complaints, and one of us loved it with no complaints whatsoever.
Yep. Another way of putting that would be 3 positive reviews and 1 ecstatic review.
Yeah.
Nick, I would say that, like, I think on my second viewing of it, like, an overall positive framework for it. Would you say that you have an overall positive?
Oh, I have... it was great to see Burnham again, and I overall am positive. I just have some problems as well.
So let's say where it takes place.
So, yeah, the end of season 2, spoilers, they had to... take the Discovery 1,000 years into the future, which is further forth than we've ever seen Star Trek go.
Right. Correct. Essentially, like, there was something dangerous, and if they stayed anywhere in their current timeline, it was going to get them.
Yeah, they wanted to be like, what, the 31st century instead of the 23rd?
It might even like be like 3,100 century or something. Yeah. I thought it was like 3,200s or something. Yeah. I might be wrong.
Maybe it's 30. Well, at any rate, they're way in the future, further than we've ever seen Star Trek go. And Burnham guided them using this sort of the Red Angel suit.
Yep.
Right.
So this opens with her coming through the wormhole and smashing into a ship.
Yep.
And then...
They both crash.
Making landfall on a planet.
Yep.
And then it stays with her. We actually don't see the Discovery in this episode. Next episode clearly is going to be the one where...
No, the Discovery's gone. It's destroyed now.
Oh, interesting.
I assume.
They do tease because she's going through... There's a belt of... Or a thing of space debris at the beginning. And it has a saucered ship that looks suspiciously like the Discovery, but is not the Discovery.
It's not the Discovery, yeah.
That is actually my biggest gripe.
No Discovery.
No crew. It's just Burnham. Which is very reminiscent of the first episode of Discovery, which is
that we are on the same page, and that I didn't start clicking with Discovery until I saw her interacting and bouncing off the regular crew members.
That makes sense. I think that's why I'm into it, is because for me, and partly it's because I'm just not as big of a Star Trek fan. Yeah. Like, I'm not attached to the universe. I like Discovery. Yeah.
But I like the crew and their sort of energy together.
I do too, but I like Discovery from the very outset. Like, I like Discovery from those first 2 episodes that a lot of people don't like.
Yeah. You are a big Discovery whore.
Mm-hmm. I like the sort of survival sci-fi that they were doing, which is basically she lands in this, and it's not survival exactly because she's still in civilization, but she's like
she's in the Badlands kind
of cut off from everything she's known.
Yeah.
She's in this distant future,
and she ends up teaming up with this guy whose nickname is Book.
Space Druid.
And he's, as presented, more like Space Smuggler.
Yes.
There's going to be some reveals later on, but he But he feels he's a Han Solo type.
Yeah.
He's a roguish, cockney-accented, good-looking black guy.
I like Book immediately.
I like his character,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, I think he's a good character.
He actually, the D&D character I'm playing right now, I, like, am trying to not make myself write in a cockney accent because his cockney accent is very charming.
Yep.
Although, also, because of the weird nature of my CBS All Access, I can't get subtitles, and once in a while, I was like, what the shit did they just say?
Am I wrong, though? That's not exactly how it opens. Doesn't it open up with the guy who is sort of a series of...
It opens with someone doing a series of, like...
Waking up
with his bird alarm clock.
So you get the sense that he's doing it over and over. Imagine a person who's, like, alone on a star base, who gets up every morning, gets dressed in his nice, clean suit, and sits at a desk and waits for some other voice to something to happen,
you know,
and nothing ever happens.
It's not unlike Desmond in Season 2 of
right.
Lost.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you find out that what we will find out is that Starfleet in this future has been just utterly decimated by an event called the Burn. And do we want to kind of
say what it is? So, like, dilithium, which is the heart of star travel, basically became unstable, and so they couldn't trust it, and so, like, starship travel has become a lot less common.
Yeah, and not just, like, unstable, like, it detonated, it sounds like. So we're, like, talking, like, tens of thousands, if not more, ships exploding across the galaxy. Mm-hmm. No more warp travel. Their long range sensors or whatever, like, really kind of only see a few sectors beyond what they're in.
Yep.
And they don't, like, know what's going on in the rest of the universe because nobody can see that far anymore.
Yeah.
And it's kind of lawless.
Yeah.
And the smugglers are, like, after dilithium, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, like, one of the big things because they need to.
Well, they use it for their, like, you, in order to make a run, you go and you get enough dilithium to make.
Yeah,
it
the
run.
Red dilithium
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
Just like red matter.
There are really interesting ideas here. It's very dark.
Yeah.
And
see, I'm all about... I love a good Fallen Empire story. Like, this feels interesting to me, the notion of, like, something like this falling apart. But I think what really sold it to me, and what made it feel like Star Trek and not, like, Farscape or something like...
Is the
tail end. And her talking about... Immediately, Burnham is like, Starfleet isn't about the starships.
Right.
And I like the notion, I don't know why, for some reason I like the notion of things looking absolutely hopeless and people still having hope.
Yeah. No,
well,
I actually thought the ending
I can't
was
imagine
great.
What circumstances you might be in
mm-hmm.
That would lead you down that train of thought, but we'll look into it later and see if there's anything
we'll see if we can
to
figure
it.
Something out. Yeah.
What I was going to say is it does have a core of sort of hope in it beyond the immediate, like, there's this is an adventure episode set in and around what I can only describe as Star Trek's Mos Eisley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the setting.
But, Nick, what were you about to say?
I just said I was jokingly referring to all the murdering that was happening.
That was something that threw me off, too, which is, like, at some point people start pulling guns that they're, like, weird
and
future
and they literally
phasers.
Get vaporized.
Yeah, when they hit it, it looks like it liquidates them.
Yeah.
And Burnham is on the run, and they're clearly not good guys. But, like, if they had just told us that this is
a
group that's, that is, like, they're like a meeting point of Andorians and Orions, which have not historically worked together, but a thousand years in the future, they seem to be doing some bad stuff.
But they're all big jerks.
They are big jerks. If they had told us they were slavers or something like that, it would have been one thing. As it was, they just seemed like jerky guys, about on the jerkiness level of Han Solo, or, like, in his bad moments.
In this future, all Andorians and Orions kick puppies every day when they wake up.
I'm just saying, it was a little bit...
She's just killing them right and left on
I
the way out.
I needed something more. I did like drugged Burnham. I thought that she was
I
funny.
I love drugged Burnham.
I think that actress, Sonequa Martin-Green, you know, my co-podcaster Fathery, who we just podcast, of course, about this on Text Trek. It's our Star Discovery was the whole reason we put the podcast together in the first place, and so obviously we're going to be covering every episode. But he was pointing out, Sonequa Martin-Green, if you ever meet her in real life, she is very, she's just, like, effervescent and bubbly, and she has this energy she always brings to the room. But in the show, she plays someone who was raised by Spock's parents, so she has this Vulcan discipline and doesn't, like, let herself go too often. And so what he was really liking was this was an episode that allowed her, and it does seem like she's in a somewhat healthier mental place in spite of the dark future.
Yeah.
And so, A, she can express herself a little bit more, I think, just you know, healthily, and B, she does get drugged up with some truth serum that makes her loopy as fuck.
And that's what she starts murdering people, so maybe it's the truth serum.
Oh, that's okay. Then it was, she was just on drugs when she killed, then it's all
right. Exactly. That's a very Star Trek thing, right? Everybody gets on drugs and kills
It just
people.
Felt like the opening 10-minute sequence of an Abrams Star Trek movie.
Yeah.
But I hate those movies, and I like this.
See, and I don't hate those movies. Actually, I think the third one is great.
Yeah,
legitimately good.
This actually has the same qualities that I like about the movies, which is I love the character interaction and the sense of energy and stuff like that. But I feel like there's dopey plot lines, and that there's also some of the character arcs are a little bit ham-fisted sometimes. Huh.
Yeah. This makes me honestly the you guys comparing it to that. I almost was wanting to go back and watch. I watched the first 20 minutes of Star Trek and Beyond and could not get into it, but I loved this. I watched this twice, and I almost want to go find Star Trek Beyond and give it another shot, see if I'm in the right mood for it or something.
You might should give it a shot. Star Trek Beyond definitely has a somewhat slower start, but once it gets going, it has a lot of good stuff going on. And actually, I like the opening of Star Trek Beyond.
I do too. I mean, I'm going to watch the rest. Discovery is my favorite Star Trek show. I love the crew. I just miss that element.
Well, we are going to see them next episode.
Yeah,
I know. They're lost. They're not going to be there for another 1,000 years.
I did think that was an interesting idea that they just came. They were behind her in the wormhole, but that doesn't mean anything. They could come out whenever.
Yeah.
Well, right. They even suggested that it could be like it happened 100 years or 1,000 years or something like that.
Plus, Book at the end of the episode, Book has a cat, and I like that.
There is a Maine Coon in this series, which I also have. I have a cat of that same variety.
It's a chunky cat
named Grudge, and he is a very beautiful cat with really amazing fur, big chunky fluffy cat. And yes,
actually,
what's his name, Book can frequently be seen holding a grudge.
They
make that joke in the show, and it went over my head.
I didn't catch it
when she says something like why is he called Grudge, and there's something in there where he's like, he's like, because I'm holding him or something like that. And then it's like, oh, I see what you just did.
I ultimately
there.
Like his
joke.
His character, though. And
like
sort of where it goes.
Yeah.
That made me kind of smile. And, of course, the ending itself with the guy and sort of the...
ending is so good.
It's a pretty emotional ending, yeah, I don't want to quite say, like, every little tidbit that happens in there, but it's a fairly emotional sequence.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it ran a little bit dangerously close to talking about how being self-important about, like, Star Trek must mean something to people, but was also well done enough. Like, I liked that actor. I'm looking forward to seeing him in subsequent episodes. And I did find that there was definitely a beating heart beneath any sort of... It's not that I ever thought the writers were anything less than sincere. I was just like, I don't like when there's a story about how Superman is important to inspire us, and I kind of don't want Star Trek to tell us that it's important to inspire us either.
Well, Dave, how do you feel about stories about how important democracy is and how important our justice system is? Because that's our next topic. Aaron Sorkin has a new movie on Netflix called Trial of Chicago 7, which is based on a true case from the 70s.
A crazy case.
And this feels of a piece with his A Few Good Men and West Wing.
Yeah, it's because it plays to his strengths, and those strengths are courtroom cases and witty banter between a large group of people.
Arguably, it like avoids some of the pitfalls of some of the things of a longer running series by being like very tightly constructed and being based on like, you know, in focusing on the trial, you don't get to like so into the characters that some of his foibles around characters show up.
Although he doesn't, are there any really good female characters in this? That is definitely one of his weaknesses.
No. On the other hand, it was a
dudes.
60s trial.
Yeah.
I did like his the receptionist for the.
Oh yeah, she was.
She's
Sorkin,
great,
but she's like a typical Sorkin character. She's there to be of service to men. He definitely has a flaw when it comes to that.
But I don't think you can really call him out on this because that was America in the 1960s.
Yeah, it actually works. Because it doesn't feel like we're missing anything.
Yeah.
The seven, basically there are seven people who put on trial together because of...
They staged a protest.
Starts out with eight.
It does start with eight, you're right.
Right, a protest during the in front of the...
1968
Democratic National Convention. Yeah.
Right. And they're basically turned into a riot.
Yep.
And there's a question of, did the protesters cause it or did the police cause it?
Well,
I don't know where this has any relevance now.
Well, yeah, but the important thing here, though, is that It's a, from the outset, it's a political trial. Like, Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays the, one of the attorneys from the Attorney General's office. And basically, the new Attorney General is mad that the previous Attorney General
did not resign, snubbed him with some protocol stuff.
Some protocol stuff. And so he's going after these guys. And
I don't know how that could be relevant right now.
Yeah, exactly. He puts together, like, eight people who had really nothing to do with each other. Like, a few of them knew each other. Most of them, some of them hadn't even met.
And tries to paint it as a conspiracy. Like, there's some kind of anti-fascists.
Oh, yeah, or something like that.
And Sorkin is an amazing writer, and he's a competent director, but where this story comes alive is with the actors.
The casting is really good. So, I'm not a big Eddie Redmayne fan, but he's solid here.
Yeah, he's solid. The standout for me is definitely Sacha Baron Cohen.
Sacha Baron Cohen plays Abby Hoffman, and he is a delight. He is so
also. I can never remember the actor's name, but the guy who plays Jerry. He's on Succession. Mm-hmm. He plays the lead in Succession, and he's amazing. Yes.
Yeah. Their judge is this kind of like cantankerous old guy who's really not qualified to be a judge.
No, and makes these like rulings that are vindictive, suppressing.
Oh God, who's that actor?
Franklin Gehl.
Yeah.
And then there's the eighth member is a Black Panther who came in to make a speech. Like he came in, he made a speech. He was supposed to leave. Like that's it.
He's the leader of the Black Panthers.
No, he's being advised by Fred Hampton.
Oh, okay.
Fred Hampton is advising him.
Yeah.
But it's the guy is played by Yahya. I forget his
Abdul,
full name.
Basically, Dr. Manhattan.
From Watchmen.
Yeah. Hey, that's who that was.
And he is basically like, oh, their lawyer. I don't remember who's playing the lawyer of their group. They're sort of a
he's one of those guys.
Some character actor who's like through the roof good.
Yeah,
and it's all courtroom trial stuff, which can be slow. Is not here,
but it's like courtroom trials with like. '60s radicals who are also snarkily funny.
Yeah,
sometimes hilarious.
Yep.
The thing does call out some obnoxiousness on their part.
Yeah.
And some of their own foibles, but
the courtroom stuff is interstitial with like Abby Hoffman doing stand up or kind of stand up.
Yeah.
Or like scenes from the actual riots.
Showing us what happened at the riots.
I assume that a lot of the courtroom stuff is taken from transcripts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's one of those like you're watching and it's almost impossible to believe some of this stuff happened.
I read an article. I forget where the article was from. It was a reputable one. But they're saying that the movie actually plays down some of the more crazy aspects of it. It was actually crazier.
Right. Like there was probably some of that stuff where they're like, and we put this up on screen. No one's going to believe it immediately. Man, that's talk about 2020.
Yeah. But I really enjoy it. I wasn't even sure I was going to watch it. I wasn't sure I was in the mood for a courtroom drama. But this is of a piece with A Few Good Men. It's really good.
This is
and really fun. And a satisfying finale, although Dave has not gotten there yet, so we're not going to spoil it.
Yeah,
correct.
But yes, while being a slice of a different era, it is also completely relevant to the modern
era. Very relevant, yeah. Dave, you finally finished watching Haunting of Hill House.
Yeah, I'm only a few years late on it, but it does have some relevance right now because it's a spiritual sequel, The Haunting of Bly Manor, from like essentially the same writer-director and starring several of the same cast members, just different roles. It just started up a few weeks ago. And so Haunting of Hill House doesn't need me to recommend it. It was already a big hit on Netflix a few years ago.
This podcast is going to put it over the top.
This is what I'm going to make or break you, Mike Flanagan. You better. You know, Mike Flanagan's a director we've talked about recently. Randy, you've seen a bunch of his stuff.
Yep.
And like his sort of big ones are he directed Dr. Sleep. Was that Oculus?
Mm-hmm.
Hush? Anyway. But I think a lot of people don't know his name yet, but they should probably. Mm-hmm. And I think this more than anything put him on people. This was a mainstream crossover hit.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not going to do a deep dive on it, but it is it's told a little bit like It, in the sense that you see every episode features flashbacks to characters when they were children in this house, and the events that would go on to kind of change their lives. And them as adults, all of them kind of experiencing hardships of their own and breaks. You know, they've got, like, family strife, but they've also got these, like, deep connections. And it's, like, an emotionally wrenching show that is also very scary at times.
Yeah.
Really make you jump scary at times. as well as just having some of the most heartbreaking stuff I've ever seen on TV. The whatever the episode was that showed, oh my gosh, why am I going to, Nell?
The Bent-Neck Lady.
The Bent-Neck Lady episode, but that also profiled her murder, her marriage.
Yeah.
And, like, her husband is just this, such a good guy.
Yep.
And a lot of times the characters, one of the things I like best about this show is that new scenes continually recontextualize old scenes.
Yeah.
And in fact, even the very first episode in particular, there's things you see in there and you think, okay, I see what this family dynamic is. Oh yeah, that guy's the drug user and he's stealing some stuff.
Yep.
He says that's not what it looks like, but clearly he's shaking and it is what it looks like. Well, about four episodes later, you find out it's not what it looked like.
Right.
And it's a heartbreaking episode that is willing to be both critical of people and have, like, sympathy for them. It's got a cool, spooky story. I think, like you, Randy, that the ending wasn't, like, quite 100% satisfying for me. And I would have trimmed it by an episode or two, maybe.
Yeah.
But it was still, in a way, never less than compelling in a given scene. Great cast and acting, and kind of unique. There's nothing really quite like it, which is an epic tapestry like this.
Yeah.
The closest I can think of is Stephen King's stuff, like It or The Stand, where you have these kind of really, like a long-running story.
And there's a reason that, like, Mike Flanagan has sort of attached himself to Stephen King.
Yeah,
their
sensibilities are similar, including that, like, kind of desire that you, like, that the character always be the heart of it.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had a great time with it. I've had nothing but recommendations for it, and I'm looking forward to watching Bly Manor.
I was going to say, you're going to dive into Bly Manor, or is that going to be like 2 years from now?
It might be 2 years from now, or it might be just after a break of like a few weeks.
Yeah, yeah. I will say Bly Manor is different.
It's very different.
Yeah. That's okay. Probably.
No. I say that in like the best way possible. Yeah. I think it is sort of Flanagan stretching his... a little bit more than what he has shown.
Yeah.
While still staying to his core.
Mike Flanagan, Planagan.
Yes. and I think you would really enjoy it.
Yeah, I know that I broadly, like, just his philosophy, I guess, of horror filmdom is very aligned with what I like.
Yeah, well, me too. I went down a big old Mike Flanagan wormhole this mm-hmm. Halloween season. I watched Gerald's Game and Hush and Oculus and
you've definitely seen more than I have. You saw some of the lesser known ones too.
Before I Wake,
Absentia,
yeah. So yeah, I definitely went.
I think this is the hardest you've ever like gone at like a horror.
I have
list.
Watched 20 horror movies in the last 20 days.
That's impressive.
and a couple were rewatches, but mostly it's been new. Before we get to my scary movie catch up as a whole, though, I was surprised. Nick, speaking of watching stuff late. But you had not seen Trick or Treat before.
Yeah, I don't know why this never really kind of made me want to watch it.
Yeah, this is Mike Dougherty, who did some other stuff.
He did specifically Krampus, which is...
Oh, that's a good movie, too.
Which is my... It has fallen into my wife and I's always Christmas movie.
Your new tradition?
And I feel like Trick or Treat has now become sort of a Halloween tradition because...
Well, it's so Halloween-y.
It is.
He also did, of course, he wrote the screenplay for X-Men Apocalypse and X-Men United... And Superman Returns.
And, I don't hold any of those against them because
and
those
Godzilla
have been
King of Monsters.
Everything
that was good. I liked that.
Everything he built will fall.
But yeah, it's weird. Like I look at it and it's like, wow, you want to talk about a mixed record? Because yeah, Krampus is good and Trick or Treat is great.
But clearly, like horror is kind of, I think, what we're going to connect for.
It's
with
a little like Joe Dante or something like that.
Yeah. Don't step too far outside of your...
So this is an anthology of sorts. It is not unlike, say, Creepshow like that, but
true.
It's basically one big story.
Yes, it's like five different stories kind of conforming and contorting into one giant thing.
And the thing, it moves through time a little bit differently. Like Dylan Baker's character shows up in an unexpected place.
Yep.
And you're like, oh, wait, this is after the other thing I just saw?
Yeah,
and
it's a little Pulp Fiction-y and it's time jumps.
Yeah.
Brian Cox plays a really big, important role, and I love Brian Cox.
Yeah, Brian Cox is really good in this.
Anna Paquin.
She is like, it's her and her sisters, and they're like doing their slutty Halloween.
Yep.
And there's this dangerous guy walking around. It seems like it might be an actual vampire. And that story takes a twist that you did not see coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of just having a good
time.
They're
all fun vignettes.
Yeah.
The one that I thought was one of the most fun ones was the kids taking one of the, like a another kid down to the bottom of a rock quarry try to scare the hell out of her.
And how that goes.
And how that goes. I was like, oh, this feels like a Stephen King thing.
By the way, they also introduce a horror mascot who I think is becoming people know as
Sam.
Sam, a.k.a. Sam Hain or whatever.
Yep.
Starts off, you just kind of see him in different spots.
He's like a little scarecrow sort of boy. Like Does he have an actual pumpkin head? Or no, it's like a bag
over his head. But you see what's like under the bag head later.
Yeah.
But it's funny because I was watching it with my kid, and they started seeing him and pop up. And they were like, oh, look at the baby. And they turned to me like, I know that he's probably killing people, but it's the baby.
It opens up with that... him watching, what's his name from Battlestar Galactica?
Yep, and Leslie Mann? Or Leslie Bibb?
Leslie Bibb.
Okay.
As they're sort of a happy couple.
Yeah, and she's taking in the Halloween decorations too early, and Sam does not like it.
Yeah, I turned to my wife, and I'm like, who takes their Halloween decorations down the night of Halloween?
One less person now, Nick.
I'm like, that's just... wrong.
Yeah. This is a sort of a little dark morality play about respecting Halloween.
Respect Halloween.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's got like it's got all the stuff that a Halloween thing should. It's like honestly if along with like say I'm gonna say the original Halloween from John Carpenter, and for me, Scary Stories to Tell in Dark, which takes place on Halloween. Those are like the three sort of Halloweeniest Halloween movies.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, because you guys both really liked that. Mm-hmm. And I finally got around to watching because I got short
time. If I remember correctly, Dave, you saw that, what, three times in the theater?
Yeah, it was kind of a weird thing where I wanted to show it to a few people, and I just ended up seeing it separately with them several times.
So I think to some extent I got slightly overhyped because I liked, but and also I've been watching so many horror movies right now, like the bar is pretty high.
Yeah.
And this was like, this was in the same ballpark as Trick or Treat for me. I thought it was a really good, I liked all the different stories they were telling.
You just said you really like Trick or Treat, though.
I did really like Trick or Treat.
Okay.
But I wouldn't put it up there with, like, Insidious.
That's interesting. Oh, you don't like Trick or Treat as much as Insidious?
No, I don't.
That's interesting. I think because I like different movies for different reasons so well, I would probably put this up there with Insidious, but as a different kind of movie. It's like an all-ages horror movie that's got a little bit more bite than maybe expected.
Their scares are good. Their creature designs are great.
Yeah.
Like, I love their scarecrow. I like the weird weird lady who swallows the one kid.
Yeah,
like,
it was specifically based on these the illustrations from a creepy old kid's book series from the 60s onward, I think.
Yep. Okay. I like that it's a period piece. I think that was really clever.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess that... I don't know if they decided to do that because those books were first drawn in, like, the late 60s or maybe early 70s or something like that, but...
It was a good move.
Did you know about that, Randy, that these are based on books?
I did know that, yeah.
And then there is a conceit that this girl who's the lead character, who's a writer, kind of has some... ends up with some insight into this ghost sort of thing that has these sort of scary stories that the woman wrote in life seem to be coming to life... sometimes with her friends and stuff now trapped in those, kind of stories that range from, like, eerie stories to gross-out stories to... There's some weird gross ones.
The one with the sister.
The spiders thing was gross.
That was super ridiculously gross, in a fun way.
Yeah.
You know what I thought was interesting was that other than the kind of... There is a sort of town bully in this.
Yeah.
But there's not, like, quite a villain per se. It functions like a lot of gothic stories where you're really... It's more about discovering secrets.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, who volunteers to go to Vietnam? I was waiting for that kid.
Oh, in the 60s?
Yeah.
Kids volunteered.
Yeah, it's crazy. They did.
Yeah.
Also, randomly, I like when Gil Bellows shows up. I've always liked Gil Bellows.
Who is Gil Bellows?
He's the sheriff.
Oh, okay.
I just like that actor. He was on Ally McBeal for a long time.
Because of my fondness for anthology stuff, I started trying to watch the new show on Shudder, the Mortuary Tales or whatever.
Yeah, the movie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could not plug into it. Clancy Brown plays like a mortuary... He's playing like the Crypt Keeper type guy, and I'm like, that is the wrong role for Clancy Brown. And I got about 30 minutes into it, and I was like, yep, nope, this is not for me.
Oh, interesting. I've heard good things about it, so it's on my list.
But we should lightning round this thing, Nick, because you and I have watched a ton of horror movies.
Yeah.
So you had you have a bunch. So
my bar is I watch every horror movie regardless of.
Well, you're burning through a bunch of stuff on Shudder, right?
It's everywhere. Shudder, okay. Amazon, Hulu. Hulu's very impressive with their list.
Hulu's got some good stuff. I know that you and I both watched Scare Me.
Yes.
And I really liked Scare
Me. It's the Iacash.
Iacash and the guy from Saturday Night Live. No.
No, no.
College Humor or one of those.
Yeah, he actually, this is, he wrote and directed this one and starred in it.
He cashed in his 401k to make it.
Oh.
Wow. And then it like premiered at like Sundance and he only got to see it once. But it's really good. It's basically just this failed writer. He goes to this cabin. And he runs into a woman who's like written this super successful horror book. He's kind of jealous of her, and the two of them wind up when the power goes out telling scary stories.
And then the a pizza delivery guy gets in there.
gets involved in it. Yeah, it's really. I mean, I kept waiting for the twist.
Yeah,
and it does come eventually. But by the time they came to it, I was like, wait, is this a twist or is he just messing around? And but mostly this is just them telling scary stories, and they do bits like where he's telling a story about a werewolf. And he's like telling, he's walking around, and then they'll show him like having an actual werewolf claw, so you get the imagination thing going.
Yeah.
It's very clever, very well done. The characters are really good.
And Iacash is always great.
And the stories are fun. Like,
yeah, they are.
And they're kind of busting each other's balls about like what the story is telling, and they change the way it's going, and they're like, you get to see them develop the story.
I think this one hit a little bit more for you than it did for me.
Yeah, I really liked it.
I know my brother was watching it, and he hadn't finished it when I talked to him the other day, but I think he was like, good and bad, but he wasn't completely into it.
Right.
No. See, I think you gotta watch it all in one go. I think this is one that you really need to watch all together. But then there was, in similar like horror comedy mode, there's Vampires vs. Brooklyn on Netflix, which I was not super into. I know some of our friends really
liked. Okay, and this is the direct opposite. I actually really enjoyed Vampires vs. Brooklyn. I liked its sort of campy nature.
I thought the premise was good, not the characters were good, but I feel like it needed a little punch to the script or something. Like, the dialogue wasn't there.
Yeah, I could see that. It kind of scratched an itch that I wanted, though.
Yeah, I get that.
And I love the sort of the bodega stuff and them watching Blade in the back room. And I like when kids band together. And there were some really cool sort of story elements for the different kids, too. Like, one being kind of roped into being in a gang.
Right.
And, of course, we get the vampire familiar, who is the actor who's in everything. He was in Homecoming.
I don't remember.
You would know. Okay, but it doesn't matter. But he's one of those actors that is kind of just a character actor.
Hmm.
Man, it's gonna bug me now.
I liked it. It's fun. It is of a piece with something like Lost Boys, or not on the level of Lost Boys.
No, it's not on the level, but it's close.
Or, I mean, some people compare it to Attack the Block, and I'd say it's in that vague, that ballpark. Like, I wasn't super.
If you haven't seen Attack the Block, that's worth watching.
Yeah, and that's on Showtime as well, I think. There was also on Shudder a movie called Deep Murder that I watched that has Katie Esselton from the
Shea League. Wiggum.
What's that?
Shea Wiggum,
right.
Yeah, he.
Called Deep Murder, that is basically, it is a Skinamax, like softcore porn movie. and then a murder happens, but they're all still in character as these, like, it's in the world of softcore porn, and there's, like, a private
where all the weird, goofy stuff is normal to them, right?
And then they're trying to solve who is serial killing them.
Oh, interesting.
It's super funny and weird. I feel like it should have been the same length as, like, The Host. It should have been about an hour, because it wears out its welcome fast. But it's pretty funny. And on the level of, like, a much funnier version of that is The Final Girls, which is on Showtime, which is basically a group of high school kids get trapped in an 80s slasher movie.
Yep.
And a sort of Groundhog's Day type thing. But it's not like repeating, but they are in the movie. They know what's supposed to happen.
Right.
It's called Last Action Hero.
Last Action Hero,
It's
for
Last
sure.
Action Hero horror.
Yeah. but that was a lot of fun. I watched that last night.
That was a good cast, too. Malin Ackerman and... Tasia Farmiga, which is Vera Farmiga's daughter.
I figured. Yeah. And then, God, who's the guy from Pitch Perfect?
Oh,
Adam Devine?
Yeah, Adam Devine, and also maybe from Arrested Development.
Right, and Thomas Middleditch is always great. So yeah, it's got a good cast. It's
which one is that?
He's from Silicon Valley.
Final Girls.
Final Girls. Nick, what about, you've got like a bunch of lists on.
Okay, so let's talk about 1BR, which is One Bedroom, which is a weird one. My wife picked it out. And it is about a down-and-out woman in Hollywood who's not being very successful with her career, looking for a place to live, and finds this one-bedroom apartment in this kind of blocked off kind of area, a group of apartments, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and things quickly go downhill. And I don't want to get too far. I don't want to spoil this one because I think it's best going in. Just know that it is a little bit like The Invitation.
Okay.
It's creepy.
Is it slow burn like that?
It is. It's slow burn. It's effective.
Invitation was, I thought, one of the best horror movies I've seen in the last few years on the creepy front.
It is still one of my favorites.
Yeah.
This one doesn't reach quite as high, but it's close.
Okay.
And I actually thought the performances were really good. There are scenes that will stick with me for quite a while.
Okay.
Which I was impressed with. I think, Dave, you saw this one, but maybe not. The Perfection?
Nope.
This is
at least I don't remember the name.
It's the woman from Get Out, the girlfriend.
Oh, yeah.
And about cello students. They're, like, master cello students. And she's kind of like, she had to quit her cello career to take care of her mom. And it's about the up-and-coming that she sort of befriends and have a romantic relationship with. And things go weird. It's a story of sort of revenge and a lot of other stuff that I think is better left experienced. But Steven Weber plays a pivotal role in it.
Okay. I like him.
It's really interesting. I rewatched Fright Night, which I love.
Yeah.
Original?
The remake. I like the original. I even like that come more than the remake, but the remake is so watchable.
Yeah, I rewatched it just maybe 6 months ago or a little less.
David Tennant is great. Anton Yelchin is great. Mm-hmm.
It is a fun rethinking of it where I felt like they came up with a good new version of it. It's not one of those where I feel like it kind of was like, just like pisses on the original or just doesn't. You know, the worst mess up is like when you get like, when you have like, was it RoboCop and Total Recall and stuff like that, where they remake them and they're just kind of bland rethinks with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This one is one where I actually think it's a pretty worthy rethink.
Yeah, it's got energy in it and it's, you know, got good music.
The repartee between, by the way, David Tennant and his like beautiful assistant.
Yes.
Who like gives him shit constantly. Yep. And like they clearly have like a love hate relationship.
Yeah.
Is a lot of fun.
And Colin Farrell does a good job as the bad guy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's great at being a
as
Willy.
Jerry.
I actually think I think Colin Farrell is a super talented actor.
Yeah, he is.
But this was one of those fun roles, and I have like an innate love of things that are essentially remakes of Rear Window,
yep.
And that's what all versions of Fright Night, at least to some degree, are.
You even like Disturbia, I think.
I even like Disturbia a little bit. And that's Shia.
I actually like several Shia movies as well. So
yeah, he's kind of,
he's grown on me.
He's grown a bit.
I will mention the movie Sweetheart, which is on Netflix right now, which is imagine Castaway meets Predator.
Okay.
As it basically opens up with a woman.
Why would the Predator want to hurt Tom Hanks?
I know, right?
No, he's hunting Wilson.
But she washes up on an island. It's a small island. She can walk around pretty easily. There's forest. One of her friend's bodies has washed up with her, so there was definitely some accident. But literally, I think like the first 20, 25 minutes is silent.
Yeah, that's a shame.
It's just sort of her on an island trying to sort of figure shit out. And
what's this one called?
It's called Sweetheart.
Okay.
And things. A monster is definitely introduced, and there's more to it.
Is this one from, like, Blumhouse?
I believe it was.
I seem to remember that they had a straight, what was kind of called, like, a monster movie.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's how it was being billed, Blumhouse's monster movie. And so, yes, I at least remember this one now from some trailers or like, a behind-the-scenes thing that I saw. It was one that I had wanted to see.
And I like the creature. The creature has a cool look.
Okay.
Then I saw the movie Love and Monsters, which is one of the VOD movies that just hit, was supposed to be in theaters. The main star is the guy from the Maze Runner movies. He is actually pretty watchable. He's very, as this kind of kid in a world, an apocalyptic world where all of the insects and animals have sort of been mutated into giant sort of versions of themselves.
Uh-huh.
Just think Guy Davis reimagining a centipede.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you kind of get the thing. It's tongue-in-cheek. Yondu shows up at one point, which
he's always fun.
He's
you
amazing.
Mean Michael Rooker? Not
I do.
Yondu.
I know. I do mean Michael Rooker, but I always. But my wife refers to him as Yondu. So I was like, okay.
Yeah.
And
do you think when whoever Jim Valentino or whoever created the original Yondu was creating him, he never thought this guy is going to become a household name one day?
Nope.
There's a lot to like about this because it's not just a silly adventure movie. There's actually some real heart and good storytelling involved about this kid and a dog that he finds on the way to sort of find the girl of his dreams. It's a little Why the Last Man.
Okay,
all right. But I definitely recommend it. The final one I'm going to mention is The Cleansing Hour, which is on Shudder.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a reality television show that focuses on exorcisms.
Uh-huh.
And what happens when they are confronted with a real demon.
Okay.
Everything goes great.
Yeah, everything goes great. That sounds like a very trite thing. Yeah. Like, we've seen that
I feel like
before.
I've seen some version of that, but it's a decent enough idea that...
But it's down to sort of the characters and sort of how we were introduced to their backstories and their friendship as sort of the main guy and the person who is running the scam, essentially, are kind of tested.
Yeah.
And it's got a good sense of humor, but there's also some good frights. It's just a really interesting idea.
Okay.
Okay.
You know, one of my favorite found footage movies is Last Exorcism.
Oh, yeah.
That was one where, like, you know, just based on the premise, it might not sound great. But, the characters really elevate it, so.
I'm just glad Randy fell down the Insidious rabbit hole.
Oh, man, Insidious is so good.
Because you watched them all, right?
I did. I watched all of them. And then...
The Last Key, the final one, was really good.
I really liked it, too. And I know it's the lesser outing for people, but I actually liked it a lot.
I think I found that as the series moved along... What I liked about it changed a little bit, and the focus changed a little bit, and it became more like the Elise show.
Yeah,
but I'm like, I enjoyed that show too.
Yeah,
so I really
Elise is a great character.
Had no,
I
in some ways I have had no major complaints with it as it's moved along.
Yeah, I just want more movies with Elise and Specs and Angus, Tucker.
The first two Insidious movies are the movie that scared Kaylee like utterly.
Oh, they're terrifying.
Yeah. She was like. I got up to, after we finished watching the first one, to get, like, some popcorn or something out of the kitchen. She was like, turn on all the lights.
Yeah.
I mean, and I was like...
Those movies give me goosebumps. Like, that. Like I get the hair on the back of my neck kind of thing. Like, it scares me.
And you also get good performances from Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne.
Yep,
I mean,
speaking of Patrick Wilson, just as a quick aside, one of our mutual friends, Amanda, posted the other day a What's Your Scariest Scene in Horror Movies? And I didn't think too hard on it, but one of the ones that came to mind, at least for me, was in Conjuring 2, the sequence with the painting.
Oh, God, yes.
Which I rewatched it on YouTube, and that full sequence from beginning to end is actually like 5 minutes long. Like, it is really like they stretch your nerves out to the point of popping as you know, you they kind of keep subverting what exactly you expect.
James Wan is pretty talented with that.
So I have two more for my list.
Yep.
In addition to, I rewatched Cabin in the Woods. My kid finally saw it, and they loved it.
Super good time.
And then I watched Before I Wake, which is under Mike Flanagan. This is a Netflix original. It was in 2016.
Yeah, I didn't really know about this one.
So this is basically, and I don't want to give it too much away, but it is a couple. They lost their kid. He died really young, and they adopt a new kid. Have you seen this?
I did see it.
And
it's good.
It's horror, but it's also, like, uplifting. It's really good.
I didn't know
really
it was Mike Flanagan, though.
Yeah, it's Mike Flanagan.
That sort of makes sense with sort of the, kind of the core moral of the story.
Just somewhat recently, I think when I saw Dr. Sleep, that's when I started connecting the dots, and I was like, oh, he did this, which I liked. Oh, he did that, which I liked.
Yeah.
Oh, these are all movies that I like sort of philosophically because they tend to care about the characters. And if they're not all uplifting, they have some element of kind of, like, character heart or something that counterbalances the abject horror.
I think leads in that. I forget.
It's Kate Bosworth, and I don't remember who the male lead is. But I sought out Mike Flanagan this season.
Oh, Tom Jane.
Insidious was one of them. Oh, it's Tom Jane. Insidious was one of them because I knew I liked Lee Whannell from Upgrade and
Invisible Man. Yep.
And so
on a rewatch, Invisible Man.
So I watched all of Insidious. The other thing is, like, I want to watch all the Mike Flanagan stuff, and that's how I watched Gerald's Game and Dr. Sleep. And we talked about all this last week or the week before, I think.
Yeah.
Before I Wake is the last one I think Ouija Origin of Evil is the last thing I need to find, and unfortunately it's not streaming anywhere
fun
right
movie.
Now.
Fun movie.
It is.
But the other thing I watched finally was...
That one, by the way, is not as deep as his other stuff. Yeah. It is like a true all-ages kind of popcorn-y movie. You know, like maybe in at least something of the same vein as Scary Stories.
Yeah, I imagine.
Just a little different.
A little darker.
Probably a little bit darker.
But the last thing I watched was Bird Box, finally. The Netflix original that is Sandra Bullock and... It's got John Malkovich and some other people in it. Sarah Paulson.
Right when it hit, there was all these memes related to
it. It was like a thing.
Yeah, and then it just kind of disappeared. But it's like a movie worth remembering, I think.
Which is good because I knew.
But yeah, you didn't know too much.
I didn't know anything. I didn't know there was flashbacks. I didn't know anything about it. So I enjoy. I love a good post-apocalyptic survival movie, and this was that. I thought they did a great job with the characters. I liked their established world. They did a really good job with some of the scares.
It's a world in which these creatures seem to move around, and to see one would drive you into suicidal insanity.
Or homicidal madness.
Or homicidal madness in an instant. Like, you see it, and it's just like, boom, your life is over.
Yeah.
And so people have to sequester themselves inside, block up anything that might see outside.
Yep.
And if they go outside, they have to cover their eyes.
Yep.
Now, the things... I can't remember, Randy. The things generally leave you alone if you don't see them,
they
right?
don't attack you. Yeah.
Yeah, it is more about the... And this is definitely one of those big things where it's, like, mostly a mystery as to exactly what's happening.
Yeah.
But, yes, there's a lot of... Like, the sequence where she is actually on the river with her kids and will only look through this gauzy, like in a blanket or something like that. And there's also, like, predatory humans and stuff around. And someone is trying to call to her and stuff like that, and she doesn't know what to make of it. That sequence is very intense.
Yep. It's really good. I liked it a lot. So, yeah, that's our scary movie catch-up.
You know what I'm going to just quick mention is I think we might have talked about this before, but the excellent CBS All Access show Evil is available on Netflix now. And if you haven't, it's like probably 10, 12 episodes or something like that.
Yep.
And it is like if you have any fondness for something like The X-Files or even Supernatural, it is both a mixture of kind of like fun and spooky, and is a really good time. Great characters on it.
Yeah, we get a song stuck in your head at some point.
Yeah, but
if you enjoy watching Hulu's Marvel Hellstrom and are disappointed, which you will be, you can go watch Evil instead because it's a better version of that. All right, that'll about do us for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.